is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You gotta be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You gotta hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that!
All right, welcome to the 9th episode of the Sub 70 podcast. This is Jay. It is Wednesday, February 21st. The Genesis Open wrapped up on Sunday with Bubba Watson, your winner for his third time at Riviera. He'd been playing, you know, better lately. It's still kind of crazy to think of the Volvic golf ball deal and his drop and kind of that whole situation over the last year or so. Just kind of ridiculous and hilarious all at the same time. I don't necessarily vibe or jive with Bubba's personality and some of the stuff he says and the way he acts, but I'm all for more polarizing guys on the tour, whether you like them or you don't like them or, you know, whatever it is. It just makes it more interesting to watch. And I will say that watching Bubba golf when he's shaping the ball the way he does and when they're showing the top tracer shots and all that stuff, it's pretty cool. It's really cool, and it's fun to watch. So Bubba's got 10 wins, which is pretty amazing. But this episode has the bulk of it is an interview with Len Zeme. Len is a 50-plus year sports journalist. He covered a ton of golf events going all the way back to the 1968 Western Open at Olympia Fields. He has a ton of knowledge on golf in general and in a lot of the big tournaments over the years, and then also personal experience in the Chicago area as far as playing golf, covering golf, and whether it's professional events or amateur events. So Len spent most of his career with the Chicago Sun-Times. He then moved on to the Daily Herald, and now he's doing some sort of freelance stuff for other publications that cover golf. The topics of conversation range from old tournaments and what it was like covering the tour back then, all the way to some of his favorite courses in the Chicago area, what it was like covering Tiger when he was coming up, and of course, some conversation on our favorite local tournament, which is the John Deere Classic. Some people call it the fifth major because it's that awesome. So here is our interview with Len. Thank you, Len, for taking the time to talk with us. If anyone has any feedback, please check us out on social media at GolfSub70.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Really excited to have Len Zeme as our guest today. He's been covering golf for 50 years. Len, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always fun to talk golf, you know, and I'm off in Florida where I think it's a little easier to play than where you are right now, Jason. But golf is going to be back in your area pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it, even though we're covered with about a foot of snow right now. Well, my first question is, how did you get started, you know, 50 years ago as a golf writer? How did that come about, and how did you get in this line of work?
Yeah, you know, I liked to play golf as a kid, but I was really into other sports. But, journalism was my thing, and I went to the University of Missouri Journalism School, and when I got out, my first job was with the Times of Hammond, Indiana. And one of my first assignments was in 1968. I consider this as kind of my start. The Western Open at Olympia Fields. And that was my first big tournament. And I've had, a lot of smaller ones, a lot of, we covered back there. That was a smaller paper. The paper sponsored an amateur tournament for the area, men and women. Junior tournaments and stuff like that. So it was really a grassroots thing, but the Western Open of 68 got your appetite going with Jack Nicklaus winning and Arnold Palmer in the field and so on. But I moved over to the Chicago Sun-Times in 1969 and was there 41 years and was the golf writer virtually all that time. In addition to covering other sports, hockey, I was the Blackhawk beat writer and the Northwestern beat writer, things like that. You weren't just a one-dimensional writer back in those days. You had to cover a lot of different things, but golf was always my favorite thing. And then right upon retirement from there in 2010, the Daily Herald invited me to come on board there, and I do a lot of freelance writing, but it's the Herald and Chicagoland Golf have kept my hand in the game, and I wish I was a better player, but I've certainly enjoyed my time around golf.
So back when you started, compared to, say, the players of today in this broad scope of 50 years, how has access to the players changed from a reporter? And back in the 70s, 80s, did you have more access to the guys than you do, say, from the Tiger era on?
Boy, that has it ever changed. You know, I was mentioning earlier that first tournament at Olympia Fields, and at that tournament, you know, the Western Open was as big as they got back then. It had just lost its status as a major. But the interviewing, as I recall it, we had about a half a dozen newspaper guys there. And they'd bring in Palmer, they'd bring in Nicklaus, and we'd just sit around a round table and just basically chew the fat. They'd have a beer and a cigarette, and we'd ask them questions, and they'd be on their way. Boy, that changed so much as time went on. Now, of course, you don't really get access unless you are able to go to an event that is not a competitive event. And there are some of those. There are media days in which the defending champion comes in. I was just at one here in Florida for the Valspar tournament, and they had the Canadian player Adam Hadwin there. And, you know, they're just fine talking to one-on-one, but it's really hard to line up one-on-one talks with a big-name player anymore. Every now and then you can get lucky doing it. I think you were right, though, in suggesting that the change came with Tiger. I mean, the interviewing in the press room was gradually getting more and more people around. The need for a moderator kept more television. And then, of course, when Tiger came, bang, it all changed completely with him for, you know, the bulk of his career there. And it hasn't really changed. You know, the interviews at tournaments are, they're kind of antiseptic, to be honest with you. The players are pretty much programmed. On the one hand, they know kind of what they should be saying or know what the questions are going to be, and they're prepared for them. But you can't beat a one-on-one interview. You really can't. And that's something that I do kind of miss at the pro level. Now, you still have a lot of one-on-one stuff at the very top amateur ranks. I mean, I've covered the U.S. amateur 2 years ago in the NCAA tournament last year, and the players are real good guys that you can just have conversations with and get a lot out of and enjoy their company. But unfortunately, that isn't really the case on the pro tour much.
So from those guys in the 70s and 80s, I'm 44 years old, so I remember 80s golf, and I've been around golf my entire life, but it seems like there was more characters in the 70s and 80s, and the game wasn't quite 24/7 as serious. That's my take, at least. I don't know what yours is on there. And then from that era of guys, when there was more openness with reporters, was there any guys that you really enjoyed spending time with, and is there any great stories of some of these characters from that era of, you know, the Roger Mulpies of the world and guys like that?
Well, you know, the real character, the first one that I really came across was Tommy Bolt, who was known for throwing clubs, and he won a U.S. Open. I mean, he was a good player. But then Sam Snead, they were, you know, he was the golfing hillbilly, a tremendous athlete, just to not say nothing about being just a good golfer, a tremendous athlete. But you know what, the one, if I had to cite one incident that really reflected the difference in players now and then was, it goes back, I'm thinking, to around the late 80s, and Chicago had landed the U.S. Senior Open at Medina, And then there was later was held at Olympia Fields too. But anyway, that first one, we weren't so familiar with senior golf back then. I hope my years are right here. I know at Medina in 88, I believe it was, in 97 at Olympia. But in 88, we really didn't know all that much about the senior tour, the 50 and older guys. And so to promote it, it was the Sun-Times, the Tribune, and I think they're probably the Herald. I'm not sure, but there was only like three or four of us. And at this tournament, big tournament was going to be coming to Chicago. And the tour, the senior tour, was playing in Boston. So we traveled a lot more then, and we went out to Boston with really the purpose of not worrying about the tournament that we were covering there, but that we wanted to get Arnold Palmer. We wanted to all have big stories on Arnold Palmer, what kind of guy he was and all that. So we went through all of us working together. That was the important part of it. It wasn't one paper trying to updo the other. Every all needed the same thing. So we arranged to meet him. He was going to have dinner with some friends at a restaurant there. And he said he'd meet us there. Well, we all got around the table, and in walked Arnie with his wife and a couple other couples. And, they didn't have to do this, but he came over, sat with us for an hour while his party just sat there and braced for dinner. I mean, we were looking for was a few comments to kind of say we had an Arnold Palmer story, and he gave us all kinds of background. And that was what he was like. He kind of carried the day back then. You had other good players, free spirits. I always looked to Sam Snead and Tommy Bold as being the first in my era, but going beyond them, I mean, I'm sure there were Bobby Cruickshank was a guy who had that reputation back in the day, before me. But they just don't seem to have the same kind of fun guys anymore, quite like they were then. I mean, all worlds have changed since then, and there's no reason the golf world shouldn't have as well. But Arnold Palmer was the guy who really triggered it into a new era.
With meeting Sam Snead, did you ever get a chance to meet or talk to Hogan or Byron Nelson?
Not really. They were, they were kind of fading out at the time I was getting started. I mean, they would show up at events, but they were more in a ceremonial capacity. One time I should allude to one back in my days at the Sun-Times, it was in the dead of winter, and Sam Snead was in town to promote a book that he had written. And he contacted the paper, he contacted us, and he came to the paper, and we sat in a little room over there, and he rattled off one joke after another after another after another about his time on tour, some of them a little on the off-color side. But he would be the one that that kind of, in my era, he was kind of the one that he was the start for me and that kind of stuff. He was still playing. He played in the first U.S. Open that I covered in 1973. He was still playing. And the other ones, they were around, but more, as I say, more of a ceremonial thing. They hit ceremonial first shots. They would be interviewed about their days back in the world of golf, just like we're doing today for me. It seems like it is a long time ago, but in a lot of ways, it seems like yesterday.
Well, let's talk about golf in Chicago, since we're both from this region here. And what are some of your favorite courses in Chicagoland, and what do you think about the history of golf in Chicago makes it so special?
Well, take the first one. That'll be the easiest one. Chicago had its courses early on, in the early days of golf. So there's so much history, especially on the North Shore courses. Well, it's really interesting to me that Chicago Golf Club, the first 18-hole club in the United States, is going to be back on the tournament scene this year, hosting the first ever U.S. Senior Women's Open in July. I think that's that's really nice that they're back into it. But, you know, it goes so far back to the Anoensias. The courses on the North Shore had were a big part of the early years of American golf. And now, of course, those courses, they're good courses. Of course, they remain good courses, but it's going to be very hard for them to ever get a big tournament again, just because of the space needed for the stage of U.S. Open. A few years ago, they played the U.S. Open at Marion, and I didn't go to it, but it's Philadelphia, of course. But I couldn't believe that the U.S. Golf Association was going to try to do that, because space was so limited. The course was under 7,000 yards. But they pulled it off. I don't see that happening very often anymore, though. This year, we go to St. Louis for the 100th playing of the PGA Championship at Bellerive. That's not too far away from us. In Chicago, you know, we don't have a big tournament coming, a major on the calendar after this year. So it's a times are changing. I mean, Chicago was once the hotbed of all this stuff. I always felt, as the golf writer at the Sun-Times, that I had the best job out there, that I'd be able to see major championship golf all the time. And it was great for a long time. And now, of course, more new courses are built. Public courses are much better than they used to be. And, it's, as I say, it's just a changing time.
Well, kind of talking about the North Shore, and you kind of flow into my next question. What's your thoughts on all of these old golden age, golf courses, or the architecture of the golden age kind of really coming back into vogue, like Shore Acres moving way up the ratings lists, and Old Elm and Skokie and those type of classic designs now becoming really, really recognized for what they are? What's your sort of thoughts on that golden era of architecture and how much of it we have around Chicagoland?
Well, I tell you, Shore Acres, I haven't played in quite a while. That was always a well thought of course. I have played it, but it's been really a long time. Skokie, though, I'm glad you brought the Skokie up. Skokie is and North Shore. It would be interesting to see what North Shore looks like now that it's being renovated. But I thought Skokie did just a terrific job of renovating. It was a popular site for the Western Amateur twice in the last few years. That is just a gem. I think Skokie is just a gem. North Shore was always a popular course for the senior players when they came here. And, of course, then they pretty much closed down for a year. So it's going to be interesting to see what North Shore looks like. The Glenview Club was same kind of thing. I think that's always been a top-notch course with a lot of history in the early part of the 1900s, but it's maintained its popularity. Exmoor this year in Highland Park, a Donald Ross course that's going to host a Champions Tour Major this year, the Constellation Senior Players Championship, and I believe that is the first senior major held in Chicago since the U.S. Senior Open at Olympia in 1997. So that's going to be a highlight of this summer schedule.
Well, if you can get up to Shore Acres to play it after they've had the renovation, it is absolutely fantastic. If you love golden age architecture, I've been fortunate enough to play it a few times. It's absolutely brilliant with that Seth Rayner design. Next question, what are some of the most underrated golf courses in Chicago? If you were visiting, you would have to play that might not be on the radar, but would be a must play if you're in the city.
Well, you know, there's a course that I have a fond thoughts about, and it's at Cog Hill, but it's not Dubs Dread. I've always had an awful lot of fun playing the number two course there at Cog Hill. It's called Ravines is really its name, but it's, I don't know that anybody really calls it that. And that's a public course that I've always just kind of a special place in my heart to play there. If you're into golf history, You might want to take a spin to a nine-hole course. You might want to take a spin over to Downers Grove, which is what remains of the first version of Chicago Golf Club. And it's got a nine-hole course that gets heavily played. It's a municipal course. That's for the golf history side. Now, looking around the area, kind of think, my favorites, I like White Deer Run quite a bit. Trying to go, of course, Misswood is probably the best, by far the best of the new ones that have come out, Misswood and Romeoville. It'll be the site of the Women's Western Amateur and the Illinois Women's Open this year, so it's got a big year ahead there. Those are the best. I should point out, it's good that, because this is back on the tournament trail, is Kemper Lakes. I used to live very close to Kemper Lakes. And back in the day, it was the place to hold big tournaments. And then it turned private and didn't really open its doors to tournament play until this year, when the KPMG Women's PGA Championship was coming. And that's going to be really nice to have Kemper back in the rotation. I think the membership is now looking to do some of those kind of things. And Kemper's a great track. They've been doing some work over there, especially on their bunkering. And I think it'll be a real popular for a spectator venue this summer.
I know you touched on this earlier as well, but I think having a USGA event at Chicago Golf Club is just going to be fantastic for people to be able to see the course who have never had the opportunity to play it or even kind of walk it. Because of the history, because of how historic it is, your thoughts on Chicago Golf Club in general, and it's, I kind of call it the Augusta of the North, of the importance it is in golf and the history of the club and what it means.
That historically, that is for sure. It's I've played it once, and I covered a tournament over there. I think it was a Western Junior, but anyway, it was covered. Tiger was playing it, and he was the young phenom. He was still a young kid then. And I missed, unfortunately. I had another assignment. I couldn't be at the Walker Cup that was played there, I'm guessing 15 years ago, maybe. The Walker Cup matches were there. That's the last time Chicago Golf had a real big event. Would be fun for people this year if they get a hold of some of the golf history books of the building of that course. C.B. McDonald's book on golf history and how he built that course. It's a lot of good anecdotal material in there. But that's, you're right, the history part of Chicago Golf Club is the key there. It's got an aura about it, in a lot like, for the same reasons Augusta National does. It's got an aura, a mystique to it, mainly, I think, because people really haven't been playing it. They know that there is history there, that it was once a special club, and that it still is. But the mystique of having not seen it, most people around here haven't seen it. Even avid golfers haven't even looked at it. I think they're in for a real treat to just take a stroll there and watch the women play.
Speaking of bringing up Tiger Woods, I'm assuming you had interaction while covering him in your time of being a reporter. How much interaction have you had with Tiger? What's your thoughts on him overall, and what do you see for him in 2018?
Yeah, as the reportorial side, he's always been kind of a mercurial person on that hot and cold situation there. When his game was going good, he would be easier to talk to, more forthcoming. And he's gone through a lot in life, some good, some bad, some of his own doing. He's crammed an awful lot of life into and still is under 50 years old. So, a great athlete, great accomplishment as a player. I think that the expectations are unrealistic for him right now. And I say that, he's hardly played at all. He's been off and on. He's hardly played a tournament since 2008. I mean, he's really hasn't shown much. Now he plays in this hero tournament, and it's basically an exhibition, and he finishes in the middle of the field, and he's going to make a comeback. He does move the needle. I don't debate that. But that's a story that I think we should just sit back and say, wait a minute here. Let's make sure he's really back and playing. It'd be a great boost for golf if he is, but I find it kind of hard to get excited right now. I mean, his first tournament this year, he's made the cut. That was a positive. He hadn't been doing any of that. This week he's playing in the Genesis tournament at Riviera. It's, of course, he's played well, and I think that's where he played his first PGA Tour event when he was still an amateur out in Los Angeles. I think what we should all do with him is just, you know, there's so much great young talent on the tour now. It's nice to have him playing if he's going to play. But to take away the focus from the real players as of right now, the Jordan Spieths, the Ricky Fowlers, the Justin Thomases, Dustin Johnson, Tiger is an interesting story, but he's an interesting story off of his past. And, let's let him prove that he can win again before we start doing cartwheels. That's kind of my approach to it.
So do you have any updates on him doing the architectural design for the golf course on the south side of Chicago? Is there any updates you know of on that?
Well, I know what I've read about it. I haven't really been, part of that story. I just find it very hard to imagine a course in that location that could sustain itself. It's just hard to imagine that they would build a course that I'm at the last, one of my colleagues in the Chicago media covered the last meeting that they had in the Chicago Park District about it. And the bill now is, as I understand it, to build the bridges and everything. It's a $60 million project now. And I wonder if it can get built at that kind of money. I thought it was kind of a far-fetched thing that course would get off the ground. That said, the part of the plan there is a renovation and upgrading of Jackson Park, which anything good they do at Jackson Park, I am totally for that. That place is a gem historically, and it's maintained its popularity with the real recreational player. It'd be a shame to ever lose Jackson Park. I know. I remember playing over there when it celebrated its 100th anniversary, and I love Jackson Park. I think that's gonna, if that goes as part of the if this project ever gets off the ground, which right now I think it's very much a case of being a wait and see thing. I hope there's still some signs of the old Jackson Park still around there.
I know you also covered the U.S. Open last year at Erin Hills. What was your thoughts on how that golf course held up for the event, and what's your overall thoughts on Brooks Koepka?
Yeah, well, as for Erin Hills, I thought it did fine. It was certainly a lot better than Chambers Bay out in Washington, which was kind of a similar situation, bringing in the USGA, bringing in basically brand new course to hold its major championship. I thought what was really good about Erin Hills is that had all this space out there for spectator viewing. They could have taken more people, and they just packed them in. I thought it held up good competitively. Brooks Koepka played well that week, no question about it, and he's a good player right now. He's got some health issues. I mean, he finished dead last in the tournament of champions out in Hawaii. I think he's been off the tour. I think it's a wrist problem with him. So it's hard to tell where he's going to be at. you know, when it comes time to defend, because he's, I don't think he's been, I don't think he's played in at least a month, you know, in tournament play. And I don't hear reports about him being healthy and getting ready to go again. So we'll have to wait and see on Brooks, but he had that one big week, no question about it. And he's flashed signs of brilliance before that. And even after that, it's just, right now, I think he's kind of caught in limbo via injury.
Well, I know we talked about how good golf is around Chicagoland, but also our neighbors to the north up in Wisconsin is really, in my opinion, turning into a great loop. You can go up there and play some fantastic golf courses. So just trying to get your opinion on, you know, we talked about Erin Hills, and you like that golf course with now Sand Valley. The resort up in Kohler has, you know, four fantastic golf courses, Lasonia. And on the private side, you know, Milwaukee Country Club and Blue Mounds. So just getting your thoughts on overall, you know, golf up in Wisconsin and the quality that's up there.
I've been amazed. I mean, it's amazing that a state with that that climate, you know, basically a shorter season, at least a little bit than Chicago, and all this new building is being done there. I look and I liken it all to the that started with Blackwell's run, the Herb Kohler. I give him the credit for triggering it all when that Black Wolf run was built out in Kohler in the 90s. I loved that course, and I and now that he turned it into two 18 holers there, and then of course he's the other 36 holes with the. With the Whistling Straits and the Irish course, you know, they've gotten the big tournaments now. And of course the Whistling Straits will get the 2020 Ryder Cup. So that's been a hotbed now for a while. I think what we should include in the mix there in Wisconsin is Grand Geneva Resort with the Brute course there. That maintained its popularity for a long, long time, long before, Kohler got things going. I've been at Sand Valley for a walkthrough with Michael Kaiser, Mike's son, on the courses before they were opened. It was they didn't have a whole lot of grass on them then, but you could see that it was going to be something real special. And I think this year the popularity of that will really take off because the second course is going to be ready along with a short course. So I think that we'll all get a little better feel for Sand Valley this year. Lawsonia I was kind of looking at it. It's kind of a hidden gem. And I played Blue Mound, a Milwaukee Country Club. I have not. That's been a famous course too, but it's just one that hasn't been on my radar for a while. But Wisconsin, it's just amazing how that state has all of a sudden had such a golf boom. And I don't, to tell you the truth, I don't see it stopping. People seem to be willing to cross the state line and go there to play. And I'm certainly one of them.
Well, since you have all this experience in covering golf for 50 years, and there's this young group of players really kind of, you know, coming to the forefront right now. And if you look at that whole group between, you know, John Rahm and Justin Thomas, et cetera, we all know who those players are. In your opinion, who do you think out of that group over the next, say, 10, 15 years is going to be the best player in the long haul out of those young guns at this point?
Yeah, that's really a good question. I would guess that Justin Thomas would be the guy. And I don't know, if you're including guys like they're young too, Ricky Fowler and Jordan Spieth and so on. I like the longevity possibilities for Justin Thomas from this standpoint. He grew up in a family of extraordinary golf background. I mean, his grandfather and his father are both club pros. So it kind of makes you a little more appreciative of staying with the business. Now, golfers of that ilk, of that ability, that he has, that Spieth has, that Fowler has, they get into other things. You know, they're making so much money now that, you know, staying hungry is not going to, it's going to be difficult to keep the competitive juices going once they get all how much money do you need. And they've certainly been packing it in. Now, Justin Thomas, though, he's got a body that seems to be healthy, lean, hits it far, has the upbringing from the family background. And he's won. He's already got his major, and he's already, you know, been at the top of the golf world. And he's, you know, he's still, I think, 24 years old, I think. So I got to think he would be the best bet of that generation of players to be around playing at the top level when he's 40.
And then as a follow-up to that, out of these young guys, and maybe it might not be a name that is a household name yet, but is there any player, say 30 and under, that you think is underrated that people should watch and put on the radar?
Well, boy, that's a good one. Oh, yes, there is one. He's a foreign player, though. Came out of the U.S. University of Illinois, Thomas Peters. Now, I don't know how much we'll hear about him here in the States, because I think he's a happy camper playing in Europe. But he is a talent. He is a talent. He quit college early, and it was an immediate success in Europe. And I think that's a guy that we would call him underrated simply because he's not playing here and he's not competing much against these name players that we've just been talking about. But Thomas Peters is the real thing and the real deal. It's a case of how much he wants to cross the pond to play here and forward his reputation in the States. But no question the talent's there.
When you were covering golf on a full-time level, what was your favorite non-major, just a regular PGA Tour event, or it could even be a Champions Tour event? Did you personally enjoy being out there the most to cover, had the best atmosphere, great people, the whole nine yards, if you were going to suggest to somebody, go watch this event?
Oh, you know, you've got to put the John Deere Classic at the top of that list, far and away. That's been a lot of fun. That tournament back in the days when the West, they used to try to schedule the tournaments close together so players could drive to them more easily. And there'd be the Western Open followed by the Greater Milwaukee Open, followed by the predecessor to the, whatever it was called prior to the John Deere Classic. It was called the Ed McMahon Quad Cities Classic. It was called the Bud Light Classic. It had all these different names, and it was a little facility called Oakwood. The last of it was called Oakwood Country Club, a small course in Coal Valley, Illinois. That tournament took off, and you know, TPC Deer Run was built, and it's a small market, probably the only small market on the PGA Tour, the smallest one. But that tournament has been so well received and so well supported in that community. It's really a feel-good story once you get there. They have kept up the tradition of their pork chop sandwiches. They have a course now, which is a great spectator course. And the players all seem to love being there. I don't know how many years in a row I've been there. Quite a few. Because I go back to the days at Oakwood, and I look forward to going back there every year. It's a fun event. You know, it's had Steve Stricker won it three times in a row. Then Zach Johnson, who's kind of the ambassador for the tournament, he won it. Spieth won a couple times. It was known for getting players their first victory, a place where players could win for the first time. But Ryan Moore won a couple years ago. He's been a very established player. Brian Harman won his first title there, and his career has taken off. I look forward to going back to Deer Run, and it's a very unique situation in that tournament has thrived as the site the week before the British Open. Now, you'd think a lot of the top players would just skip John Deere and head take a week over there to acclimate themselves for the major. But there have been players who would prefer to play the John Deere, catch a they have a flight that leaves from the Quad City Airport. That's the Sunday night after that tournament's over and goes directly to the British Open site. And that's kept up, that's made it easy for a number of players to say, hey, you know, I'm going to stay and play the Deere. But, so that one has got to be the best feel good story out there on the PGA Tour, at least.
You know, I haven't been to a ton of different PGA Tour events, but I couldn't agree with you more. I always tell people, if you know, because it's about an hour and 15 from where we're at, and if you want to see world-class players up close and watch how they play all 18 holes and not have to fight thousands of people to watch it, it is the best tournament ever to get right up to the rope and watch these guys play. I think it's a great event and has a great atmosphere to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking to get somebody to start talking about it. I can't wait for the next one. And it's only a few months away. But the John Deere is that's always been a season highlight for me, regardless of what big event might or might not be in Chicago or on my schedule. But the JDC, that's got its niche in golf, that's for sure.
Out of all the four majors, what was your favorite major to cover as a journalist, and why did you enjoy it so much?
Well, you know, I tell you, I had I've been a real lucky guy. I had my first U.S. Open, 19 sets, kind of a convoluted way to get to the answer, but my first major was in 1973, and it was the U.S. Open when Johnny Miller shot a 63 in the rain at Oakmont, which was the record for a long time in major scoring. So that was a good memory. Then in 86, Mike, was my first Masters. And, of course, we know what happened there. Jack Nicklaus won his last one. And I don't think that I've ever had a sports event with as much emotion packed into it as the final round on the Sunday round on that Masters. The Masters is a great course for drama. And its time in the season is very good. It's when people are just across the whole country getting interested in golf. The snow is melting and the cold weather climates and all that. I think the U.S. Open probably carries the most weight of all the majors, the three majors in on American soil. But I have been interested in the PGA a lot as well. I think it's the best run of the majors and it always has the best field. So I've kind of not really answered your question there, but I think that if I had to pick one of the majors each year to attend, and I could only pick one, I think it'd be the PGA for that reason. It comes at a time when the weather is probably going to be at its best. It might be really hot, you can never really judge by that. You're going to get the players playing their best at the peak time of the season, and it's been won by an awful lot of great players. So, and it bounces and it bounces around. Unlike the Masters, it bounces around to high quality courses wherever it goes. So, I think that if I had to pick one, it would be the PGA. That might surprise a lot of people.
I did not think that would be the one, but I understand completely where you're coming from. The field is great, and it's always great to see at the end of the year of, one guy going after one major, and with that it usually turns out to be a really exciting tournament. So I understand where you're coming from. So my next question, I'm just going to throw out some tour players that you probably have covered, and just give me your quick thoughts on them. There's no right or wrong answer. I'm just going to give you a name and let me know what kind of comes to your mind. Jack Nicklaus.
Well, he's the best ever. He's a model citizen off the course, model player on the course. His competitive approach to competition was unparalleled. He was number one. The Bear was number one in my book on about every level.
Greg Norman.
Greg Norman was a great talent and a terrific driver of the golf ball. He also had probably, as great a talent as he was, he probably was the most unlucky of the players with great talent. He led all four majors after three rounds and only got one win out of it. He was always in the hunt for a long stretch there, and he got beat by some miracle shots Most notably, I guess, when Bob Tway pulled a bunker shot to beat him in the PGA at Toledo. His career, Norman's career, wasn't as long as these other guys. He came back and threatened to win the British Open, though, after having not played at all, hardly at all, for a while. So he's become more of a businessman golfer. But when he was good, he was very, very good.
Ernie Els,
the Big Easy. Well, he's got a swing that really has held up for an awful lot of years. It's going to be interesting with Ernie when he really decides, or if he even decides, that he wants to be a Champions Tour regular player. He's been working a lot now, as he's got a son with autism, and Ernie's done some great things else for autism. His fundraising and support of that program has been exemplary. He's won four majors. He's won two U.S. Opens and two British, and swing still holds up. So, you got to have a lot of respect for Ernie. He's done a lot of good things.
Phil Mickelson.
Well, Phil Mickelson is the left-handed side of him. He seems kind of programmed in interviews that he's always got a story to tell. He's a cooperative guy. He's done a lot of good things as a player, and he's hung in there. You can't knock the quality of play he's produced over the years. I don't know. He's always been kind of a sort of a mystery to me. I don't know. It's hard for me to get a grasp on the kind of guy he is. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. It sounds like it, but I don't mean it that way. He's just he's been a hard guy for me too. He's had his great moments, and I don't think he's a bad guy or anything. He's had issues with gambling, apparently. That's behind the scenes stories that come out there. He's just a guy that I've had a hard time figuring out.
Dustin Johnson.
Well, now that's probably the best athlete to ever play golf. I think his distance. He's unbelievable. It's amazing he hasn't won more than he has. He had a little problem with a suspension from the PGA Tour few years back, but I think that he's dedicated himself to golf. He's certainly really, really improved his chipping and short game, general short game, and I think that he's going to win a lot more. It's a case of which tournaments he turns out winning as to where his legend in the game will wind up. But he's a player. He was a great athlete as a basketball player. I doubt there's a sport he couldn't play, but he's, the raw talent is certainly there.
Patrick Reed.
Funny guy. He seems to have a lot of fire, plays very good match play player. I think to me, he kind of gets mad at himself or hurts himself with his temper a little bit, but he's won. He's won. And sometimes competitive fire is a good thing. I would think that it'd be hard to keep it going over the long haul that way. You can't argue with the talent. He's got the talent there. As I say, I think that maybe he fights himself a little bit too much.
And my last question I have for you, what is the biggest surprise we may see in golf in 2018 on the PGA Tour?
On the PGA Tour, well, I tell you, we saw an awful big surprise last week when Ted Potter won at Pebble Beach. I don't know if we can get a bigger surprise than that one. But let me think. Now, we haven't. I don't know if it's going to be called a surprise, but I think that this is the year that Ricky Fowler is going to win his first major. And I don't know if that's a surprise because he's already won the Players, and he was in the top five in all four majors one year. So that's not really considered a surprise, but, I guess that would, you know, a lot of people say, well, he hasn't won one yet. I think this is Ricky's year.
Well, Len, I can't thank you enough for being on our podcast. I really appreciate your time, and thank you for everything today.
Sure enough, Jason. Well, best of luck, and I'll see you when we get back to Chicago.